Welcome back. It's the second half of our episode, and I hope you had a restful break.
I did. And now we're going to talk about One Night in Miami, which, unlike Insignificance,
the names
of the people that are involved are readily given out. But without further ado, Claude will now give us the plot description for One Night in Miami.
Yes, this one also opens with a title card, but unlike Insignificance, it says this film was inspired by true events. It is 1963 when we start, and the film shows us four different things going on at roughly the same time. First, we've got Cassius Clay, who's played by Eli Gore. He's nearly losing a boxing match to Henry Cooper at Wembley Stadium in London because he is spending so much time taunting Cooper that he opens himself up to a direct punch. Meanwhile, at the Copacabana in New York City, soul singer Sam Cooke, who's played by Leslie Odom Jr., is making his debut at that club in front of an indifferent, all-white audience. Then we see NFL player Jim Brown. He's played by Aldis Hodge. He's making his return home to Georgia, where he is received by family friend Mr. Carlton. That's Beau Bridges in a cameo for this film. On a huge plantation, Carlton heaps all kinds of praise on the great Jim Brown. But when Brown offers to help Carlton move some furniture, well, Carlton drops the N-bomb and informs Brown that he is not welcome inside the home due to Brown's race. And finally, we see Malcolm X, played by Kingsley Benadire. He returns home, and he's discussing his plans to leave the Nation of Islam with his wife, Betty. We move forward in time, and a graphic tells us that it is February 25th, 1964. The men are all gathering in Miami for Cassius Clay's title bout against Sonny Liston. Malcolm meets with Cassius in a hotel room before the fight, and the two pray in a traditional Islamic fashion. That night, Jim is the ringside commentator, and Sam and Malcolm are in the crowd as Cassius upsets Liston, making him the world heavyweight champion. Afterward, Malcolm invites the other three men to his motel room. Sam arrives first and, sitting alone in this rather run-down space, starts picking out a song on his guitar. The other three arrive together, and it's pretty clear that the three guests are expecting a party, but that is dispersed quickly when Malcolm makes it clear that they're the only ones he invited. Malcolm wants to spend some time reflecting on their accomplishments, but tension between him and Sam arises. Malcolm accuses Sam of disloyalty to the black community by pandering to white audiences, and Sam argues that his method produces greater economic empowerment for black artists. Cassius informs the men of his plans to announce his conversion to the Nation of Islam, causing more tension. Malcolm steps out of the room, saying he left his camera in the car. His assistant-slash-bodyguard Kareem, played by Lance Reddick, accompanies him. Malcolm goes to a phone booth, telling Kareem he's going to call his wife. He explains that he wanted privacy to do that, but he didn't want to put the men out of the motel room. His young daughter answers the phone, and he directs her to a note that he had stashed in the bookcase. Back in the motel room, the three men sip from a flask and discuss whether Malcolm is being a little too insistent about things. At one point, another Nation of Islam member named Jamal, he's played by Christian Magby, pops into the room, ostensibly to see if they need anything, but he's really just looking for autographs. They ask him about the Nation of Islam life and whether he has any regrets. Jamal says his one regret is that he didn't join up sooner. Back outside, Malcolm is still on the phone with Betty, who, by the way, is played by Joaquina Calacongo. He tells her that Cassius is going to announce his new religion, but he doesn't know whether Cassius will go along with his plans, which we don't really know about yet. From the phone booth, Malcolm spots a couple of white men at the edge of the parking lot, and he ends the call. Back in the motel room, Brown discusses his plans to become a film actor and wonders if it will go smoothly. Cassius thinks he's being hired as a token character. Malcolm comes back into the motel room and says he might be being followed. He begins to check the room for bugs. They move to the roof, and he talks about being harassed by the FBI and a premonition he's having about conflict between himself and Elijah Muhammad. Then he tries to convince the others to join him on a pilgrimage to Mecca. Cassius appears to be in, but the other two decline because of their schedules. The conflict between Malcolm and Sam escalates into a scuffle, and Kareem appears out of nowhere with Jamal to break it up. Their mere presence is enough to end things, largely by changing the focus of their anger, and the men return to the motel room. As they argue, it becomes clear that Malcolm's antagonism of Sam is motivated, at least in part, by the activist's stress over his own life, especially his harassment by the FBI and fears about his schism with Elijah Muhammad. Malcolm is devastated to learn that Cash is having second thoughts about his conversion, largely because of the heat that the nation has been getting. The conflict between Malcolm and Sam begins to escalate. Malcolm ridicules the music Sam has produced since finding success. Sam insists his success and creative autonomy is itself an inspiration to the black community. What's more, he notes that the white co-opting of black-written songs works in the blacks' favor because they wind up getting the lion's share of the royalties. Sam also points out the inherent hypocrisy in Elijah Muhammad living like a pharaoh but not doing much about the corruption in the city surrounding his huge house. And while he's sensitive to the struggles in the black community, protest songs, they're not commercially viable. Malcolm counters by playing Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, and Sam angrily leaves the room. Cassius tells Malcolm that he went too far, but Malcolm protests that the time has come to quit standing on the fence. Cassius goes out to get Sam. Jim notes to Malcolm that economic freedom is the key to the whole thing, and what's more, he's painfully aware that people still view him as a black man, not as an NFL hero. Cut to Sam and Cassius coming out of a liquor store. They are confronted by a couple of youngsters asking them for spare change. They get in the car and discuss Cassius's impending conversion to Muslim and the need for them to stick together. Cassius defines power as the freedom to be themselves without answering to anyone for it. Then he asks Sam point blank, "What do you want?" Sam replies, "I want a damn party." They return to the motel room and announce that they're going to take things to his room at the Fontainebleau Hotel. Malcolm asks him about the first time they met and then notes that he's been to 5 of Sam's shows, including one in Boston, where he followed Jackie Wilson. Shortly after he started singing, the microphone cut out and apparently it was Jackie Wilson's doing. When the band abandoned him, he began to stomp the stage rhythmically and brought the crowd around to doing it with him. Then he started singing Chain Gang a cappella, and that's when Malcolm realized what a powerful future Sam had. Malcolm tells Cassius that he's planning to leave the Nation of Islam to form his own organization and asks him to join. Cassius angrily refuses, feeling betrayed by his mentor and wondering if his conversion has been a ploy by Malcolm to attract attention to his new project. There's a knock at the door, and Jamal informs them that the press has gotten wind of the meeting. As Cassius prepares to talk to the media, he asks Malcolm to come with him. When they leave, Sam tells Jim that he's had similar thoughts about Blowin' in the Wind and has already written a song, but not yet performed it. After Cassius speaks with the press and announces his conversion, the men hit a nearby bar and genuinely celebrate. Malcolm participates but doesn't drink, and he spots the same white men in the parking lot taking notes. In the aftermath of the night, Sam debuts A Change Is Gonna Come on The Tonight Show. Clay officially changes his name to Muhammad Ali, while Malcolm's life is thrown into chaos as he suffers the consequences of his split with the Nation of Islam. His house is firebombed, but he does manage to complete his autobiography. Jim leaves the NFL to pursue his movie career, and the film ends with a title card with a quote from Malcolm on February 19th, 1965, about the inevitability of martyrs for the cause, and notes also that he was assassinated 2 days later on February 21st.
So, this is based on a play by Kemp Powers, who also wrote the screenplay. Now, unlike Insignificance, where the meeting between the four characters is completely imaginary and they never actually all meet together in one scene, although they are all in the hotel room in one scene near the end. It's just that Monroe, the actress, is in the bathroom while the three men are in the main part of the hotel room. But it is true that Malcolm X was there when Muhammad Ali beat Sonny Liston to win the heavyweight boxing title. It is true that Jim Brown was helping to call the fight. And it is true that Sam Cooke was also there at the time, and that the four of them did sort of get together. But what happened at that meeting was entirely made up by Powers for his play and then for the movie. And as a matter of fact, the conflict that drives the play, which is the conflict between Malcolm X and Sam Cooke, it was also made up by Powers. As far as history notes, there was no major conflict between the two of them. Powers based that on his experiences when he was writing for the show Star Trek Discovery and his feelings about whether he should use his life, about using his life experience on the show when talking about race. And there are other anachronisms here as well. A Change Is Gonna Come actually came out before the match between Ali, Clay, and Liston. But overall, as with Insignificance, Powers and Regina King stick closely, if not to the truth about what may have happened that night, but the truth about the personas of each of the famous folks that they were depicting. And I'll get to those depictions in a moment. But first, Claude, other than the fact that this was, again, a filmed play, even though it's opened up a little, what did you think of it?
Yeah, now this one, I had to look to see if it was based on a play because I wasn't watching the opening credits very closely. And because, again, it was this, like, most of it takes place in a single spot. And I said, okay, this could be a play, but we've got the scenes at the Copacabana. We've got the scenes at the liquor store. We've got the scenes on the roof. We've got, like, this was a much more, you know, open kind of situation where you were in more locations. You just had a bigger sense of the world around what was going on. You were in different places in the world, in fact, because you started the film in London, and then we come to Miami. So, you know, I really bought into the whole thing. I didn't have that little thing of a play hanging over my head, which I think worked out really well. You know, the arguments between Cook and Malcolm X, you know, they kind of went on longer than I think were strictly necessary. But for the most part, I kind of bought the relationships between these men. I understood the motivations that they, you know, without, you know, being beaten over the head with them. I think it worked out really well in many respects.
Well, the arguments between Malcolm X and Sam Cooke in this movie are arguments that have been going on in the African-American community for a while now, you know, so it's not something that, again, is made up out of whole cloth.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying
it wasn't the argument between these two folks specifically.
I'm just saying, like, they both kind of made their point much earlier, and, you know, that it kind of continued into another location, you know, didn't make a pile of sense to me. They'd already said pretty much what they were going to say, and then they wound up saying a lot of it all over again.
Okay. When I was younger, my youngest brother and I would get into arguments all the time, and or disagreements, maybe, if you want to be if you want to soft pedal it. But, you know, oftentimes I would say, okay, that's enough, and then I'd walk away and he'd follow me and he'd continue it in another room. So I do think that's part of human nature.
Yeah, okay.
You know, that they've argued about something and they argue about the same thing again. Mm-hmm. So that didn't really bother me. Now, you know, the boxing scenes, the scene with Bo Bridges, by the way, his character is based on a real acquaintance of Jim Brown, who did not let him into his house for the same reason.
Yeah.
And scenes with Sam Cooke and his wife, who, by the way, wife Barbara, by the way, was played by Nicolette Robinson, and she's Leslie Odom's wife in real life. And scenes of Malcolm in the parking lot, you know, all those were added on to open up the play. And another thing that Regina King and Tammy Riker, who is a cinematographer, who's done such movies as High Art, Ali Sheedy's temporary comeback vehicle, and then also a movie called Beyond the Lights, which I liked a lot. But they move the camera around a lot, if you notice.
Yeah.
And they also frame the actors in a way so that even though all four actors are often in the same room at the same time, Malcolm is always a little isolated from everyone else, to show that he's sort of isolated from the three other folks in there, because, you know, you've got Sam Cooke, who's supposed to represent something that Malcolm is not happy with. And then you've got Ali, who's converting to Islam, but is not quite on board with everything that comes with being a Muslim. And then you've got Brown, who, while he's certainly sympathetic to Black empowerment, and as a matter of fact, in a book I have about Howard Cosell, you know, he once explained in the book to Cosell that he could never be friends with a white man, no matter how much he respected him, because of the way that whites and African Americans were unequal in this country. So even though he believes in all that, he also is not going to become a Muslim, partly because, as he says, you know, have you tasted my grandma's pork chops?
Yeah.
But also there's that line he has toward Malcolm, where he wonders if light-skinned African-Americans feel they have to be more forceful in their views in case they get accused of not being Black enough. So
yeah, he's just generally a more pragmatic guy in general.
Right.
And maybe that comes with the fact that he might be a little bit older than most of them, too.
Yes, but you know, that's, you know, the visual way that King and Riker show Malcolm in isolation reflects how he is in isolation with the other characters. Now, speaking of Malcolm and the actor playing him, as well as Ali and the actor playing him, of all the roles being that are played in this movie, the real life people, and in addition to the four major ones, we also have brief appearances, of course, of Malcolm's wife, Betty, and then also Ali's trainer, Angelo Dundee, who's played by Michael Imperioli, and his second, Drew Bundini Brown, who's played by Lawrence Gilliard Jr. So clearly the casting director of this movie was a fan of HBO.
Yeah.
But of all the actors playing those main roles, Kingsley Benadire and Eli Garee, I think, had the toughest jobs, not just because Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali continue to be resonant figures in the African-American community, somewhat overshadowing Jim Brown and Sam Cooke, but also because Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali have already received iconic portrayals in movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we discussed, of course, Denzel Washington playing Malcolm X in one of our earliest episodes, but Will Smith played Muhammad Ali in Michael Mann's, in my opinion, underrated biopic of him. Ali. Both of them ended up getting a Best Actor Oscar nomination out of their performances, although neither of them won. Ironically, Washington won the year Smith was nominated for a different type of role in Training Day, but both of them are competing in a way with those performances, even though other actors have played Malcolm on screen as well. But while they're both competing with those legacies, I think Kingsley Benadir does a good job playing Malcolm, and Eli Goree does a good job playing Ali. Now, Benadir, I didn't even know until I looked him up that he's actually British. You never hear the British accent slip out, or at least I never heard it. And while I hadn't seen him in much before this movie came out, the only thing that I remember seeing him in, and I saw it after the movie came out, even though he did it before, was he was in the TV spinoff of the novel and the movie High Fidelity, which we briefly mentioned when we talked about the movie. He's playing the ex-boyfriend of the main character, Rob, on the show. And I think he does a good job of showing Malcolm's philosophy, his inner struggle, his charisma, and his moments at the same time as moments of vulnerability, like when he's talking with his wife or when he's confessing that he's thinking of leaving the Nation of Islam, at least the nation in the U.S. Whereas Eli Goree, of course, he's got Ali's brashness down, but he too shows a more thoughtful side as well when he's playing Ali. Now, he, I had seen in, let's see here, he'd been on, actually, I haven't seen him in anything before this. Though he was in the 2014 Godzilla movie, which I did see, though he didn't have a really big role in that. But in this, you know, he does convince me of Ali, even though I am going to say Will Smith was better, just as I think Denzel Washington was better in playing Malcolm X and Kingsley Bel-Air. I think they both do a good job here.
Yeah, they do. And it's interesting because I usually when you've got an actor and they have like their accent doesn't slip, you really want to like, you know, go look at who was the dialect coach for this particular film. And it was somebody named Trey Cotton. But it turns out he didn't do dialogue coaching for Benadir. He did dialogue coaching for Eli Goree and Leslie Odom Jr., but for whatever reason, not for Benadir. So that is entirely on him, it appears. So good on him. But yeah, I think you're right in that. Benadir and Goree really had they had to carry a lot of the weight on this, you know, specifically because, as you say, they are they were figures who, you know, have kind of stuck in the American consciousness for one reason or another. For Malcolm X, because he got cut down a year later, and you know he's always been, you know, this kind of like almost like a martyred sort of person. Muhammad Ali, just for being Muhammad Ali and you know, being famous and being good at what he did and telling everybody he was good at what he did. He was just this larger than life personality. And
well, he was also martyred in a way, of course, not by being killed, but having his career unlawfully taken away from him.
Yeah. But the bottom line is they've maintained this fame, whereas Jim Brown is kind of like faded into history a little bit, and ironically, he's the only one still alive of this, you know, group of four. And then Sam
when
Cooke
the movie came out, he's no longer alive.
That's right.
Alive.
He has since died. But Sam Cooke also, like, within maybe a year, almost a little bit more than a year since after this, after the events of this film, he got cut down and in this weird motel, oddly enough, incident. And, you know, as rock stars do, some endure and some do not. And he was, like, still a rising star at that time. He was quite famous in the moment, but, you know, as others come in to take his place, he kind of fades into the background. You know, he didn't rise to quite that level where he would be always in the pantheon of pop stars. So you've got these two characters who, even though really the focus on most of this story is between Sam Cooke and Malcolm X, it's really Malcolm X and Cassius Clay that have to carry a lot of the weight of the story.
Right. Now, at least King did right by casting a talented singer and musician to play a talented singer and musician. Leslie Odom, of course, most people will remember from Hamilton, where he plays Aaron Burr.
Yeah.
And he also wrote the song and performed the song it plays over the closing credits, Speak Low. But you know, he certainly sings well as Cook. He's got that charisma and he's got that inner fire there as well, especially when he's arguing with Malcolm. And when Malcolm tells that anecdote about Cook being able to get the crowd rolling, even though his microphone had been turned off or went out, you believe because of the way Odom performs in the movie. You know, even if you may not like what Malcolm says about Jackie Wilson, you know, you forget that when Odom is performing there as Cook. And, you know, even when he's performing Change Is Gonna Come, which is, I think, the one song that Cook has done that has held on throughout the years, because it's become part of the civil rights and the African-American movements. You know, that's the one holdover from Cook that hasn't faded away.
Sure.
But for me, the MVP of the movie, acting-wise, is Aldous Hodge as Jim Brown. Now, Hodge is the one whose career that I was most familiar with before this movie. His most memorable role for me and for other Friday Night Lights fans was playing the quarterback Ray Voodoo Tatum in a few episodes of the first season of that show.
Mm-hmm.
But he's done a lot of other TV and a lot of movies as well. You know, he was on episodes of Buffy, Boston Public, Charmed, ER. And he was also in the Coen Brothers remake of The Lady Killers. He was in the underrated movie American Dreams, spelled with a Z at the end. And he, you know, he's been in a couple of the Die Hard sequels. He's worked pretty steadily and he was in Hidden Figures. He's worked pretty steadily without ever becoming a star. And whatever else you have to say about Jim Brown in real life, you know, he's another one of those people like Ali who were talented at what they did, but did not have the best track record in treating women, among other things. But while the movie doesn't really get into that aspect of it, you know, we only see the folks who treat their woman right in this movie, Malcolm X and Sam Cooke. We only get that aspect of their lives. But Aldous Hodge, again, like Gary Busey in Insignificance, you know, he carries himself as an athlete, so you believe he was an athlete, and you do get the sense that, as you mentioned before, because he's slightly older than these guys, he has more life experience. And while he certainly shares the politics of Malcolm, he's more reserved, thoughtful. He's not as much of a firebrand as Malcolm was. He can see the obstacles more clearly, maybe, than Malcolm can. And Hodge does a good job communicating all of that.
Yeah, he absolutely does. Like I said, he's an older guy. He's a little bit more pragmatic. He manages to bring Malcolm around to Sam's point of view a little bit when they're out of the room. And you know, he knows enough. Like, he can pick his battles, basically. He's good in that respect. He's matured enough. And it's not as though he would not necessarily join Nation of Islam, but he would support the effort. So, like, for instance, like, as you mentioned earlier, you know, when Muhammad Ali had his boxing license revoked, he was one of the people who stood up for him and said, like, no, you're doing the wrong thing here, and you've got to, like, make this right somehow. You know, he was part of what was called the Cleveland Summit. So it was him and Bill Russell and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. There were a few others involved in there. And right. They were basically putting their careers on the line, whether it was for athletics or for acting, you know, because they were backing him up as far as his refusal to go to Vietnam. And so he basically was able to find the moment and use it at the right time. He knew how to time himself well. And I think that's one of the things that he managed that, you know, getting back to the film, that that Aldous Hodge was able to convey is that, you know, these things are going to happen. You just got to, like, pick your moment to do it.
Right. Now, let's talk about some of the technical aspects of the movie. We mentioned the moving camera already. Mm-hmm. The weakest part of the movie for me, quite frankly, are the boxing scenes, both the fight with Henry Cooper and the fight with Liston. I know why Regina King wanted to include them, not only the Liston fight for obvious reasons, but also you get to see Ali at work here, but they're shot in such a perfunctory style that, you know, you think of, you know, of all the movies that have shown boxing scenes, and I'm not even just talking about movies that are about boxers, whether real life or fictional representations of boxers, you'd think they would have studied those movies enough to at least make them look more compelling. But ironically enough, while those were put in to open up the play, they look the most like a play, at least as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, I kind of get that. The only thing I don't get, though, is why they literally changed the ending of the Liston fight. You know, in the film, Liston, like, the round ends and they go to their corners and Liston basically throws in the towel and doesn't come back out again, when in fact that's, like, one of the most famous photographs of Muhammad Ali ever. Well, it was Cassius Clay, is him knocking down Liston and that shot of him standing over him. And I figured, you know, because we had this little extra bit about, like, Malcolm X being a fan of photography, and he was taking pictures during the fights, you know, like, that we would see him, like, almost as though we were going to give Malcolm X credit for taking that particular photo, and it wound up, like, not ending the same way at all, which struck me as a little bit weird.
I'm not sure why either, but who knows? But
we don't.
Anyway, the rest of the movie, I think, you know, technically works. Although the movie was shot in New Orleans, which is standing in for Florida, it does a pretty good job of standing in for Florida. And another thing that King does, but disguises well, is the hotel room, the motel room, I should say, and the roof of the motel that they all wander onto at some point. Those are all sets. Yeah, the motel room, you know, that's pretty obvious that it's it could have been a set. But the roof actually looked like a location. So I was surprised to learn from an interview that was on the DVD that I have of this that it was a set. But everything looks convincing and it looks, you know, it mixes well with the actual outdoor scenes, which are the parking lot, where Malcolm spots the FBI agents following him, or when Ali and Cook are going to get liquor.
Yeah,
you know, those are all location scenes, and they fit with the rest of the movie.
And then I guess they had to use stock footage for the Fontainebleau, because there was one exterior shot.
The stock footage for what?
For the Fontainebleau Hotel.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think so. But anyway, I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry on the first fight, and maybe, you know, Ali knocked down Liston, but in the actual fight, Liston did not come out to answer the bell for the seventh round, and that is how the fight ended. So are you thinking of maybe the second fight between the two of them with the so-called phantom punch?
I guess that's possible. Yeah.
Okay. So one other bit of trivia that I want to mention here. At the end of the movie, we see the montage of all four of them and what happened to them after that one night in Miami. The movie that Brown is shooting that he talks about in detail, the Western, it's a movie called Rio Conchos. It was directed by a guy named Gordon Douglas, who's probably best remembered for making the giant ant movie Them.
Yes. And
the movie co-starred Stuart Whitman, Richard Boone, and Tony Franciosa.
When are we going to cover that film, man?
Rio Conchos?
No, Them.
Oh, I don't know. I'll see if I can pair it with something else. But we are going to cover a movie with Tony Franciosa in the near future.
Nice.
But do you have anything else you want to add before we wrap this up?
No, I don't think I do.
Okay, so both of these movies are available on DVD. Criterion Edition DVDs, which I own both of them. They've got some good interviews, both of them.
He tells you that because you can borrow them from his house if you can find it. So.
Ha, 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 ha. But if you prefer to watch them streaming, Insignificance, you can either watch streaming if you subscribe to the Criterion channel, or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, whereas One Night in Miami you can only stream if you subscribe to Amazon Prime.
Well, cool. And what's coming up next time around?
Next week we're doing Love During Wartime, the war being the Cold War, and we'll be talking about from the year 1988, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, directed and co-written by Phil Kaufman, and from the year 2018, a movie called, appropriately enough, Cold War, written and directed by Paweł Pawlikowski. And both of those movies are available on DVD. Cold War is available on a Criterion Edition DVD. But again, if you prefer to stream both of these or watch both of these movies online, you could rent or buy The Unbearable Lightness of Being through Amazon, Apple TV, DirecTV, and other major streaming services. Whereas Cold War, right now you can exclusively stream that through Amazon Prime, or you can watch it on Freevee if you're willing to put up with the ads. Freevee is what IMDb TV used to be called, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you can also find us on our website, wordsandmovies.com, where you can leave a comment on any of our posts. You can also leave a email us with a comment or a question through our email address, wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. And we also are on Facebook, facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And we are also on Instagram. Is that instagram.com/wordsandmovies?
Words and Movies Pod.
And I myself am also on Facebook under my name, Sean Gallagher. And how about you, Claude?
Well, you can find me on the Book of Face under my own name, Claude Cole, or you can check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, if you like the pop music. And that's over at howgooditis.com.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much. Alex, please take us out.
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.